to The Cinematologists, a podcast for discerning cinephiles. I'm Dr. Dario Linares, and joining me as always is Dr. Neil Fox. So Neil, tell us what we've got to look forward to on today's podcast.
Well, today we're talking about Jean-Luc Godard and what he represents and the themes that come out of when of thinking about Godard. So we're looking at authenticity, plagiarism, homage, influence. And the show is built around those kind of loose ideas. So we'll have the introduction to our screening of Band Apart, which was your choice, and we'll find out why you picked that.
Indeed, we'll get into that in the main section.
And then we'll have the audience discussion, which I thought was really interesting this week. And dropped into the middle of that, we're going to have us kind of discussing some of the themes that came out of it, and then another interview.
Sure. So who is the interview that we had this week?
Well, it's great because I think what we're finding is really nice is we can kind of tie our day job into this podcast and kind of invite interesting people when they're down at the school to talk to us about these things. So this week there are some actors, some professional actors doing workshops with some screenwriters. So there's four professional actors that we talked to about acting and about improvisation. And their names are Adam Lannan, Robert Dukes, Ashlyn Diath, and Gillian Harker. And I thought what they said was really interesting, and hopefully we can kind of talk about some of the things that came out of that conversation.
Yeah, it was an interesting discussion, wasn't it, which we'll get to, where we were introducing the things, but they took it on there in a particular vein that I think we didn't quite expect, but it still was really fascinating and to get that kind of insight.
Yeah, to see it from an actor's perspective, and also kind of, you know, we see influence, you know, like someone like Godard, we see the influence that he's taken and the influence that he has. And it was interesting to hear how actors kind of do the same thing, where they take inspiration from and how they take those influences and work with them. So that was really interesting.
Great. So all that is to come. So first of all, here is the cinematologist's introduction to Jean-Luc Godard's Band Apart.
Hello. Welcome to episode 2 of The Cinematologists. I'm Dr. Neil Fox.
I'm Dr. Dario Linares.
Nice to see another sort of good audience here. Thank you if you've come back. I'm glad to see that we didn't completely alienate you last week with Repo Man. And if you're here for the first time, welcome, and thank you for coming. So, Dario, what's tonight's film?
Well, tonight's film is Jean-Luc Godard's Band Apart.
Okay, and why did you... This is your choice. Why did you pick this?
Well, I think that I wanted to pick something that would be a little bit different to Repo Man from last week. I think there are similarities, and we can kind of go into those a little bit later on. But Godard is a very sort of polemic filmmaker, I think, and somebody who is very, very influential to a lot of filmmakers, but also has a lot of critics, particularly in terms of arguably the impenetrability of some of his films, particularly later on. The film we picked tonight is hopefully his most accessible film, and so we hope you can get into it and you enjoy it. I wanted to talk primarily about Godard's kind of exploration of cinematic form, how he uses form to perhaps explore the interior understanding of the characters' worlds. So we can perhaps have a discussion of cinematic language and how it's used. I think the film for the overall theme of the podcast is going to be about homage or plagiarism. You know, how much do filmmakers borrow in a way that is recognising the brilliance of another filmmaker, and how much do they just nick stuff because it looks good? So we're going to be talking about that as we go along. But his influences are not just other filmmakers. There's a lot of influence from post-war or pre-war French literature. And he's kind of an example of the French New Wave, obviously, and we can talk about the French New Wave. And I think that their influence to contemporary filmmakers can't kind of be denied. But also, you know, where he sits in a kind of canon of understanding the greats of film throughout cinema history is really important. When I went to film school, probably the film that changed my idea of what cinema was Pierrot Le Fou, which is another Godard film. So that's the film I encourage you to see if you haven't seen many of his films and you've seen this one, you go and watch that one immediately straight afterwards. It's really, really interesting. And for me, for this film is just super cool. There's nothing more brilliant than, you know, going around 60s Paris in an open top car with a trench coat and a trilby going to pick up Anna Karina. I don't think that's as good as it gets, really.
It's interesting you were saying there about you know, the similarities to Repo Man, and then you're talking about Godard being a filmmaker who, you know, as he progressed, his work became more impenetrable and critics became more divided. That's obviously you know, a slight parallel with Cox. Obviously, Godard is a far more kind of, you know, influential and far-reaching filmmaker, but there is that parallel of accessibility then becoming this kind of, you know, almost kind of alienating sort of form of cinema. And also, as we've talked about before, is the fact that Godard isn't merely a filmmaker in terms of, in a simple sense. He is a critic, a theorist, someone who is engaged in film as a discourse. So there's that similarity as well, which I think's, you know, an interesting way to kind of start, you know, the podcast by looking at those two filmmakers.
Sure, and I think his films are definitely critical of the form in the way that they are made. So he's actually trying to do something that interrogates what cinema as a language is. I mean, the French New Wave were inspired and influenced by a lot of you know, gangster films, Western filmmakers, particularly Americans. And the French New Wave were really critical of the what was known as the cinema of quality in France earlier on. So this reliance on literary adaptations or historical epics, which were deemed to be kind of highbrow. So he's kind of redefined that notion of the classic over time. And within the film you see today, there's an express kind of exploration of the relationship between classic and traditional. What do those terms actually mean? And it's kind of paradoxical because he's also highly critical of the mainstream, as you were saying. His films are seen as existentialist films. They're about the individual. So it's this idea that the individual has free will and has control over their own understanding of the world around them, rather than understanding an individual's relationship to society through religion or these other kinds of facets. And he juxtaposes these popular cultural influences, high-minded influences, and then popular cultural influences together. So again, he fits into this kind of realm of understanding what postmodernist is. So there's this argument throughout about, you know, is Jean-Luc Godard a modernist filmmaker or a postmodernist filmmaker? I think.
Okay, how influential and important do you think he is? I mean, you know, do you think he deserves the status that he's got? Do you think he's an important filmmaker? And if so, you know, how important is he in the kind of the history of cinema and our understanding of cinema in those ways that you're talking about?
I think he's fundamentally important, really, in this development of the idea of cinema as a language. So the break that comes, perhaps, in the post-war era, where suddenly there was a whole sense that cinema had to have its own criteria of definition. Okay, so you get this sense of he's trying to fracture the aesthetic, for example. And this is most obvious in the editing. You'll see it in the film today. So he's perhaps the inventor of the jump cut. So the idea that you would cut away from a particular strand of a movie or a scene in a place where it doesn't seem to warrant the cut. So you get this kind of jarring effect. He doesn't like the tempo of the scene play out. And that's amplified by the cutting of the sound as well. So sound will be cut not in relationship to the reality of the scene that is going on, more in terms of trying to point to the idea that he is making some kind of directorial intervention to make a point beyond the reality of the scene itself. He's also he also cuts up the space very much. There's a disruption of spatial continuity, so you don't get that that sense of flow from one space to another as you would get, you know, in Hollywood films. And also in this film you see today is the sort of voiceover, the narration of God. You can see him being in charge, and he's actually speaking to the audience as the film is going along. He actually addresses the audience members who are late at one point. You know, if you are late, here's what's happened so far. So again, he's using what's known as a kind of, you know, Brechtian alienation device. He's making the audience aware that they're actually watching a constructed form rather than something that is illusory in terms of its reality, I think. Later on in his films, he uses a lot more Steadicam shots, or the immobile camera, whereas the early films are kind of related to this idea of the mobile camera, I think, a lot more. And then you get, you know, famous scenes of him using 7-8 minute tracking shots, as the famous one in Weekend, where he just goes along this traffic jam and it just goes on for 7 or 8 minutes, and then, well, I'm not going to spoil it, something happens at the end and it takes you through the whole gamut of emotions. So yeah, I think he's absolutely fundamental, particularly in this kind of like exploration of the language of cinema as a medium in and of itself.
Yeah, and all those experimentations, they still seem really fresh. They feel very contemporary. None of the techniques that he's using seem very dated.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to me because I think when we do show Godard films to students, there is a sense, well, we've seen this all before, you know, in Tarantino and what have you. But I think that the fact that you go back to his films and you see them used for the first time and in this kind of experimental form in which content and form kind of mix together in a really amazing way, it still makes them feel fresh, as you say, I think. Yeah.
Okay, so let's change tack slightly. We can't talk about this period of, you know, French cinema and Godard without talking about Anna Karenina.
Absolutely.
So what is there to say about Anna Karenina?
They made eight films together, so she was essentially his muse, really. And this is the fourth film in their, you know, in their oeuvre together, if you want to use that word. And she
you
was discovered.
Did, so.
Yeah, I know. I just well, you know, I'm all for pretentiousness. Yeah. So she discovered him as a model. She was doing adverts for Coco Chanel. Apparently, he saw her for the first time in a Palmolive ad, and she was in a bath doing a photo shoot. So he offered her a part in A Bout de Souffle. So the story goes, and she turned it down when she found out she had to do a nude scene. And he couldn't understand this. He said, well, why? Why are you turning this role down when I've seen you naked already? And she said, ah, you didn't see me naked. I was in a bubble bath. I was only naked in your imagination, which I think shows a kind of really clever appreciation and understanding of cinema, you know, from a young actress at the time, which is, you know, a brilliant retort. And she won the Best Actress in Berlin for A Woman is a Woman. And they were married in 61 and they were divorced in 65. And I think she's an icon of femininity, but kind of French femininity, I think. She's got this kind of contradictory quality of being naive and knowing, smart yet playful. She's beautiful, but she's not a bombshell. And she's also, I mean, again, go and see Pierre Lefou. She's absolutely fantastic in that with Jean-Paul Belmondo. And I think Belmondo and Anna Karenina are the two faces, really, of French New Wave in terms of the actors.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, when you look at her now, you know, in these films, she's as fresh and as contemporary as a lot of those techniques. She's almost timeless in that way.
Yeah,
as well.
That's right. I mean, I struggle to sort of think of an actress who, you know, contemporary actress who would sort of, you could say this is the, you know, the 21st century version of her. It's really difficult to put, you know, somebody who's that iconic into this day and age. I think it's rare. I mean, I don't know. I mean, where does Godard sit for you, Neil? I know you haven't seen this for a little while, so you're looking forward to it.
Very similarly, really. I mean, I had a similar kind of epiphany post seeing you know Breathless and this at university when I watched Le Mépris, which was a film that really which I really love because you know it just seemed like he's aware of the ludicrousness of cinema.
Sure.
Like what is this, you know, this is no way for adults to spend their life, but also at the same time, this is the most important thing that has ever happened to society in terms of how we can understand things. And that in Le Mépris, he ridicules the thing that he's doing at the same time, but also kind of, you know, celebrates it. No one quite does that like Godard. You know, they either have to take one or two positions. And I think that he, for this period, you know, his youth and just his kind of enthusiasm manages to get that balance so perfectly in so many films.
Sure.
Right up through kind of Alphaville, which is another film which I just, you know, absolutely loved, you know, when I first saw it. So, I sort of play devil's advocate, you know, how important is he? But, you know, I think he is, like you say, fundamental to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think with Pierre Lefou, for me, I went into that film and I came out realizing that cinema was not what I thought it was. So there's a scene in that where he's doing the long track through the rooms and the rooms are all different colours and people are discussing these sort of inane, you know, subject areas and it's all about a critique of capitalism and Jean-Paul Belmondo walks through the frame, then Samuel Fuller's in the last one and he asks him, what is cinema? And he goes, you know, cinema is violence, it's sex, and essentially it's life and this kind of thing. And I've kind of walked out and thought, you know, I've been watching these, these formulaic American films. It's like this is completely and utterly different to what I was used to, and that's what really got me into film in the way that I am now. I think.
Great. Well, we'll see if it has a similar impact for.
Let's hope so.
The other people here. So, okay, let's watch Band Apart.
So that was our intro to Band Apart. An interesting, some really interesting stuff kind of coming up there. Even though I do say so myself. Yeah. I mean, we kind of discussed a little bit about the influence that
Godard has, and also a little bit about how he has been influenced by different kinds of genres. And you can, you know, there's the obvious kind of dance sequence that takes place in the middle of Band Apart with Anna Karina and the two guys. And that was famously kind of used by Quentin Tarantino. And of course, Band Apart is Quentin Tarantino's production company. But you made a really interesting comment, I thought, about perhaps the influence of the way the camera moves. And it reminded you a little bit of Wes Anderson.
Yeah, it's weird because obviously the first time I saw the film, I hadn't seen any Wes Anderson films. And then obviously he's a filmmaker that I really love. And right at the end of Band Apart, when they go back to do the robbery, you know, for the you know, properly, because obviously it's locked the first time, which I think is really funny. There's this great shot where you see the kind of camera pans around with the car and then leaves the car and like whips up to the house where we see Anna Karina smoking in the archway. Wes Anderson uses that shot all the time. And it's kind of weird because it's something that I've become much more familiar with from his work. And it's a blatant steal. It's exactly the same shot. It's slow pan and then whip. And then we have this usually, you know, female character kind of being, you know, just magnificent and kind of framed. And that was really interesting that he's just taken it, you know. Sure. He must be influenced because there's a lot of other more indirect and more kind of sort of influences in his films, but that was such a like, wow, that's just taken wholesale.
Yeah,
a technique. It's like, it's
absolutely huge. And of course, A Bout de Souffle, Godard's first film, was remade in 84, I think it was, by Jim McBride. And this was a film starring Richard Gere and Valerie Kaprisky. I mean, have you seen that remake?
I have seen it, yeah. And it's a strange film.
It is.
I think it'd be interesting to see it now, kind of. I think it was obviously misunderstood at the time.
Yeah.
And it was in that kind of American gigolo era, wasn't it? It's
absolutely.
So,
but it begs that question, does French New Wave as a whole, you know, that kind of style and form translate into a kind of American way of filmmaking, I suppose?
Yeah, and I don't know if it does wholesale. I mean, I think what's interesting, like Wes Anderson and Tarantino, is they lift elements.
Yeah.
They lift cinematic elements.
Sure.
But there are so many other things to the French New Wave that are part of those films. And if you remove that early 60s or mid 60s to late 60s kind of French context,
sure,
and what the filmmakers are directly saying,
yeah,
then the films, I guess, can just feel really...
It seems, you know, self-indulgent, doesn't it, really? And I think that it's really difficult. I mean, is that sense, though, that we allow sort of the French New Wave to be self... Not allow them, but we sense of... that we don't kind of criticise them for being self-indulgent because it's kind of considered a particular of a time and of a place, a particular kind of style. But then when you translate that to a different context and a different country, different, you know, kind of cultural filmmaking, it doesn't really work in the same way.
No, and I think, you know, there is a lot of leeway given to that era. Not leeway necessarily, but there is often a lack of critical discourse because of the influence that they had at the time, and because of the break that they were making, and because of what they led to, you know, and it still feels like an important cinematic moment. So some of the stuff that might not work, or some of them might, and we talk about it in the discussion later on, some of it's just directly political and statements, some which work, some which don't. But we kind of forgive it because we can see what it's trying to do. But it's interesting that, you know, that we have, you know, we often criticize American cinema for stealing without context. And a lot of the stuff that steals from that just steals the things that they might think are cool, you know, that look good.
That's the accusation of Tarantino, isn't it? That it's just kind of like this bricolage of stylistic forms that don't add up to anything with any depth at all.
No, and you know, if characters direct the camera, they don't direct it in the way Anna Karina does, which is like this, this longing existential kind of, life is worthless, like directly telling the audience that, you know, that this is all just a game, and the real stuff is serious, and that is always kind of left out, because, you know, there's the idea that that's not what audiences want to see. They want to see people driving around in trilbies.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, it kind of relates a little bit to some of the stuff we teach on a regular basis about modernism and postmodernism, and, you know, there is this sense in which Godard has been kind of understood as being a formative sort of modernist filmmaker, but he has that thing where there's the breaking of the highbrow lowbrow distinction. So he's quoting popular culture, he's quoting gangster films, this kind of stuff, but he's also quoting some kind of French literature and Shakespeare and all of this kind of thing. So there's this sort of play of signification, I think, that goes on all the time, which is very definitely a kind of antecedent to postmodernism, you could argue.
Yeah, and I think it's something that kind of what would be called postmodern film has kind of mined for its techniques. But again, they, one of the accusations is that they miss out that kind of direct political discourse which is going on in these films. That these films, as much as they are pop culturally referencing, they're also interested in the world as it's happening. Not the world necessarily the world of the characters, but that external world that the film will be viewed in.
It's that distinction, isn't it, between perhaps parody and pastiche. So the idea of pastiche is just this kind of flat, superficial surface borrowing from elsewhere with no kind of recognition of the original context, whereas parody is kind of has a political edge because it's actually saying something critical about what it's referencing from.
Yeah, definitely. And as well as, I think what's interesting is that all those influences that Godard is mining culturally at the time weren't taken seriously. Mm. So we take them seriously now, mainly a lot of the time because of the French New Wave.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
A lot of these films were important to those filmmakers. So they were genuinely in love with that stuff.
Sure.
And they believed that it had a worth that hadn't been recognised.
Yeah.
And also using it as a weapon as well. I think that's interesting is that they're attacking French culture through American culture. They're breaking from their own tradition.
Sure.
So it is a discussion that the film is having with its particular moment. But using all these kind of techniques which later on would just be kind of almost dismissed as postmodern.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. What do you think to the accusation that these films are too academic? I mean, obviously we've screened Band Apart and it's the most accessible film perhaps that Godard has ever made. And if you look in his later career, it becomes more and more obtuse and difficult to understand and impenetrable, you could argue. Are these films made for critics like us? And really, they don't really play beyond a very kind of niche audience?
Yeah, I mean, well, critics potentially, but I think probably intellectuals would be a better way.
Yeah, but I think that's true.
There is so much. It's based on reference, whether that reference is another film, or like you said, literature or politics or or a way of thinking or a philosophy. They're all. It's assuming that the audience is au fait with certain highbrow intellectual ideas, which is always going to be. Problematic for a mainstream audience. So I think it's whether it's a criticism. I don't know because it's it's still the rarity that films behave in that way.
Sure. I mean, I had a thought the other night, and I don't know whether this was just kind of like came to me in a moment of inspiration or it was just a load of nonsense. But you could argue that the waning of Godard as a formative figure, let's say in cinema, is kind of coinciding with the way that cinema itself is perhaps losing its position in terms of being a central medium, in if you look sort of culturally, in a general sense.
Yeah, I think that's a very good observation, and sadly, kind of probably quite true. And I think a lot of it goes back to this idea of pastiche and homage, and what is influence in these filmmakers in these films?
Sure.
It's not the politics. It's not really the formal experimentation because they're not. They're not doing things in their own way that are formal experimentations. They're directly lifting what was back in the day a formal experimentation. And that's something very different.
And now from a postmodernist audience, let's say, or contemporary audience, it looks like, if you go back, tricksy affectations, because that's what it looks like in contemporary films.
And that's how they know it, yeah. And it was interesting because we were kind of talking briefly with the actors that are interviewed later and we kind of mentioned it, but no one really came forward, about Godard's place. And a lot of people don't really know because what has come from Godard is so widely known and so it proliferates film culture that there seems to be a lack of desire to go back to those original influences. And watching Band Apart, it remains, it is interesting because it still remains a film that is wildly experimental in so many ways, but also directly political, directly, kind of engaging with ideas. And you kind of forget that because you see its techniques used so often in films that don't get anywhere near the same level of thought intellectually or socially. You kind of assume that these films must not contain that, and then you go back and it is refreshing to go, actually, he is really interested in all this stuff. And that's what I think, that you're right, that's what's missing is that balance of,
well, it's the underpinning of existentialism and Marxism, and then on top you've got all this amazing aesthetic experimentation, yeah. Haven't you, really? So do you want to set up the interview for us? Because we spoke about some of these issues, didn't we, with these actors that have come down to visit us this week?
Yeah, so we hold up in Jam Records, which is a lovely coffee shop and record shop where I feed my two habits here in Falmouth. And we just sat down and we wanted to talk to them about some of these ideas. So we spoke to Gillian, Ashlyn, Rob and Adam about ideas around improvisation and kind of acting styles. Mm. And also kind of where influence comes from and how you use what you learn through kind of engaging with cinema in your own craft. And I thought it was a really interesting discussion. So
yeah, definitely. So we'll lead into that now by saying the first question we kind of got into was about the idea of, as Godard famously works very ad hoc with his actors, he gives them dialogues very late and doesn't give them time to rehearse. And we wondered what the actors thought about that particular kind of process.
We were talking yesterday briefly about Mike Lee, weren't we, and his techniques, and that's the sort of stuff that I absolutely adore.
But I think Mike Lee is heavily rehearsed after the process of developing the script.
Is.
I think
having
worked on feature films where you were presented with the sides the night before, that can really throw you, you know, can really throw your kilter, particularly if you've got to kind of prepare some really emotional text. You can struggle to say, well, I'm going to have to connect with this, deliver with this, and get these takes exactly right. And get all of that in my head and be really get that in the character. So for me, it didn't really work. I felt like at times I was just delivering stuff machine gun style, just to say, I've got to get all the lines out to get them all exactly right,
sure.
And they'd be natural.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because like there are pros and cons to every format of working. Like you can, I know directors that will want to rehearse with the actors and block it with the actors and rehearse and rehearse and rehearse, and then you get there and it's kind of second nature. And I know directors as well that do what you just said, like they give you a side and go, okay, just improv it, and you just go with it, and that's quite exciting. But I know what you're driving at, saying, you know, you just kind of suddenly go, oh my god, I've got it, the lines out. And I think that we all kind of agree that getting the lines out isn't our job. It's not really about the lines.
Would you differentiate improv from acting then? Are they completely two different things?
I think it's interesting because there is a certain degree of fluidity that improv allows.
It's good fun.
It's really good fun, and it allows you to have moments within the scene that are completely honest, that are completely of the moment, that you might not necessarily have with something entirely scripted. I mean, for example, as we were saying yesterday, some of the best moments in film history have been completely improvised. Mm. I think it was Rob that was saying in Taxi Driver, the mirror scene is something that wasn't scripted, and that's something that's gone down in history. What we strive for as actors is to create moments of honesty, and improv, in my mind at least, facilitates that.
I think it was Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront when Terry Molloy leant down to pick up kind of, I forgot the lead actress's name, but he picked up her glove. And people were just like, oh my god, he went completely off script. That's not meant to happen. And he did that, and everyone was just like, wow, that's a legend. Wow.
Yeah. Also, there's the line, obviously, the famous line is, here's looking at you, kid. And he added the kid on set. It wasn't in the script. And obviously, now that's, this is the thing, would it still be a famous line?
Just, sure.
Here's looking at you.
Mm.
Interesting, because yesterday as well, we were watching Start Up, and the scene that stood out to me, and you said the same thing, was one that you thought was improvised, because the dialogue just feels quite different.
Yeah.
And you can sometimes tell when something has been improvised.
Just, absolutely.
Not only does it feel more natural, there's just the rhythm is slightly different, the dynamic's different. And it's interesting, because I hadn't made that click until you mentioned it looks like it's improvised, and that's when
it looks natural.
Yeah.
Which is actually a bad thing when you can notice that. Because our job is supposed to be to make things look natural.
But is it a bad thing when it rubs up against stylized things? I mean, I think the thing about, you know, about Godard is that those films are, you know, the French New Wave films were kind of created in a certain way. So there is that sense of kind of creating things on the go.
Yeah.
But it runs through the whole film, whereas you know, something where there's an improvised scene in the middle of a scripted film might kind of take you out of the moment.
Kind of
more,
it did jar for us. We could see.
Well, that's why we picked it up. We identified it, didn't we? Mm.
But I think improv really works in comedy as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
one of my favorite films as a kid was Ocean's 11, and there are moment upon moment upon moment of that where you can just tell that they've obviously spent tons of time together before shooting, and they're just riffing off each other. Like there's a bit where Brad Pitt says just over the top of everyone else goes, scratch that. reverse it, and the guy, because the guy's got the line the wrong way around, and they haven't reshot it. They've just kept that in. And then there's a bit where Brad's trying to understand why George wants to take this massive casino, and he says, "Go on, so why? Why are we doing this?" And he gives this big speech, and he kind of looks at him and goes, "You rehearsed that, didn't you?" So it's like, he says, was it good? I felt like I rushed it. Didn't I rush it? And that kind of thing, that's that banter and that playful thing. That's what I love.
What do you think that does for the audience? Like, you know, if you're an audience member and you see those moments within those films, how do you think that makes you feel as an audience member?
Because we're an audience from an acting point of view. So we're like, oh, we get it. He's rehearsed it. It's a reaction. It's in the joke, isn't it?
But I think it works both ways, though. I think it can either be inclusive or exclusive. So at times you can be, I'm not in with the joke, or I'm not in with these guys, or at times you feel like you're really brought on side with them. So depending how it's done,
but we're more able to identify. I think if other people watching, if I was watching that film Start Up with other friends, they might not have been able to identify the slight change. We might be completely wrong. The whole thing might have been improvised. The whole thing might have been scripted.
Yeah.
But it was just the feel that it had. So
yeah, would we even notice?
I'm too biased to be able to work out.
What's interesting though, I mean, from an acting perspective, obviously everyone's different. Everyone comes from different methods of training and different experiences on set and on stage. We're all quite open to improv, but I certainly know actors who feel like it would create a great deal of pressure upon them to be funny or to be emotionally impactive. I think improv is at its best when it's you natural. Are completely the character and you can create something, again, honest.
Mm-hmm. But there is that after pressure, lots though. Of prep.
Yeah.
When you can become completely become
there's a difference
the
between
actor,
being.
The character. Then you've written all your. I mean, I don't know how you guys work, but I love to be able to build my backstory. I need to know everything about the guy if I'm playing or a girl.
How many girls have you played, Rob?
Just in case you haven't seen what Rob looks like, to make a great looking
right now
woman.
He's I'm got just stubble say that. On his face.
I don't take that as an offence. That's absolutely fine.
Okay. It's a big range, obviously. I can't see me.
I'm versatile. Yeah.
Do you think that it might be like a skill set in
playing a woman?
It is. Definitely.
Because I think that, you know, when we look at this period of French cinema, which was kind of heavily improvised, you know, there wasn't a lot of prep, you know, but then you've got people like Jean-Paul Belmondo and Anna Karina and Brigitte Bardot kind of turning out these iconic performances.
Yeah.
So is it kind of a skill set that actors have to feel comfortable with? And is, you know, how much of it is trust from the director's point of view to say, I know you can do this. Like, I know you can get on board with this project.
I mean, I know actors that are terrible at improv. It's and they will only work with scripted pieces. And then I know actors who
That's
almost...
damaging.
Well, it is damaging. I also know actors who are completely wonderful when it comes to improv. The interesting thing is, the actors that can't improv, if they're on stage and something happens, like a light cue doesn't work, or a sound cue doesn't work, or another actor can't remember their line, they're the actors that let the scene slip. An actor that's great at improv will catch that moment and use it to create a friction in the scene, create something fresh, which is always... I mean, I'm a bit of a masochist when it comes to stuff like that happening. I kind of love it. I mean, Neil came to see Great Expectations a few years ago, which I played Estella in. And in one of our performances, a massive sound and lighting cue, which was Havisham being set on fire, didn't happen. So I had to mime, listening out, going, is that my mother I hear in the background? Crap! Running off stage and hoping desperately that the guy playing Pip would get the drift, that the cue just hadn't occurred. But it's, I don't know, it's...
Did he get the drift?
He did, he was wonderful.
Good.
So thank God for that.
Going, what?
What's Ash doing?
I think on film, though, it's really interesting is the improv side. It was something that we discussed yesterday when we were talking with the students, which is when you have a script or you have an idea for a film, and certainly I've worked on a couple of films now where a director will say to you, okay, we worked on the character, you've got that trust, and so you believe in the director, and the director believes in you, and he says, this is your start point for your scene, this is the end point.
Oh, yeah.
These are the points I want to hit you to hit.
Yeah.
And certainly I've done it, and you might do two or three takes, and he's like, just refine that a little bit, take that element out, we'll go again. And it feels very, very fresh and very, very naturalistic.
Yeah.
And the films that I've done doing it, you know, we actually ended up performing as well with general members of the public. At one point there was a priest in the film who we had to speak to about, it was about this legendary kind of black shook animal dog, the creature that had been kind of out in Norfolk, And we were actually, you know, all scenes we actually have were with the experts on this. Mm. But yeah, I was in character, but I was still improvising the scene. So it's great fun as an actor. You can explore that. If the director trusts you to do it.
Interestingly, though, it took me to go... it's quite a new thing for me to be excited about improv. I used to be terrified of it. Like, when I was at uni, I hated it. And it was only after I came back from America that I was excited about doing it. And working with you a lot, Ash, like, that's... Mm. We kind of riff on scenes and play around and
we actually met improvising. We met at an audition, which involved... The entire audition was improvisation.
Improv. Yeah. Which is weird when it was Shakespeare.
It was slightly weird.
Yeah.
But I was just about earlier to say, the only thing you can't improv is Shakespeare, but I'm glad I didn't.
We did.
Improving the emotions behind the Shakespeare.
Yeah, we kept it modern for the language.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the final thing I want to sort of talk about that we were kind of interested in is our loose theme this week is homage or plagiarism, and that's why we're looking at Godard in terms of, do people homage him or do people plagiarise him? To what extent was he the same way? To what extent do you feel inspired by certain actors or performances? And have you ever kind of caught yourself like doing another actor?
We did that yesterday.
Yeah, we were talking about that yesterday. Hugely. I was saying...
I don't... Sorry, Jill.
I was just saying yesterday that there are some roles when you're watching a film where you just think, I need to be on screen. You want to jump through the cinema screen to be in that moment. And I've definitely been influenced. Jeffrey Rush in Quills, I think, was such an exceptional performance. He's playing the Marquis de Sade. And
Kate Winslet as well in Quills. Again,
yeah, I love Kate Winslet.
She was wonderful.
Yeah, but Marquis de Sade, though, is an amazing character to play.
Should we do it? You can be the Marquis.
I can play boys and girls, like Rob.
In case anyone's listening.
And, Charlize Theron in Monster. Oh, there's just some roles you have to draw upon.
Well, they say all the best actors steal.
That's what I was going to say. Angelina Jolie said nothing, that... Nothing is new.
Yeah.
Like, everyone... Like, I've read and been very fortunate to meet actors as well, I'm sure you guys have as well, and you get to talk to them and they go, oh yeah, no, I took that from there and I took that from there. And people do that. You kind of, like, watch other people and go, oh, that's really interesting. I can use some of that. And there's no... I think, what is it? People say that copying someone is the highest form of flattery.
Oh, yeah.
Which, Death of the Author. Was it Ronan Bartlett?
Something like that. Yeah.
And I also think we do get a lot of references. So up until this point, you know, I speak for myself anyway, when you arrive on set or you're auditioning, people will say, a reference. They will reference another actor or another actor's performance or a character. Quite often you're like, okay, you're not going to verbatim repeat all of those movements and actions that they do, but you will do your take on that.
Sure.
And quite often that'll be what they're looking for because that's how it's written.
And it's an essence as well. I remember I was just saying earlier, I think it was Angelina Jolie that she said, before Girl Interrupted, the actor that she got inspired by was Clint Eastwood.
Right.
Yeah.
And you think, when you look at those two performances...
Gotcha, you can kind of see that.
But at the same time, you
is
kind
it the,
of...
Is it the snarl and the cigar?
Yeah, but at the same time,
they're
so different as well. So it's... It's not copying, it's what you become inspired by. And
it's the pace, I think, in that one. I can really... Gosh, I hadn't even thought of that.
There's the dance sequence in the film we showed on Monday, which is supposedly what Tarantino showed John Travolta and...
In the
Pulp Fiction dance sequence. So it's like supposed to set this tone for that. And that's where we were sort of discussing those kinds of issues of copying. How much is that flattery, or is that just nicking somebody else's stuff?
I would love
stuff,
if someone was inspired by me.
I mean, David Lynch uses that constantly. If you look at Twin Peaks, all of Twin Peaks is paying homage to old Americana, to lots of kind of old horror films and thrillers. I mean, Barb, he's every horror villain we grew up with. It's fantastic.
But I think Quentin Tarantino, isn't he? He's the master of that, where he will actually say, this is where I draw these references from. Where a lot of directors would just go ahead and do things.
Yeah.
Quentin Tarantino's out there and says, I drew this from the Spaghetti Western, and I drew this from which is great, I think, as well, because obviously what you guys are talking about, it allows us to go back and look at these references and say,
And it opens up a new world of cinema, doesn't it, as well?
So it's like when you said Ocean's 11, I was thinking of Sammy Davis Jr. Yeah. Martin, really, you know?
Yeah. See, I've seen it. My dad was like, we've got to watch both of them. And even my dad was like, wow, the George Clooney one's loads better. But now I did this massive gesticulation, because yesterday I was talking about improv moments in films with the students, and I said, I can't remember this final one. And I've just remembered the two that I was trying to remember.
That?
One was in Lord of the Rings when Aragorn it's the second film, I think, and he boots the severed head of the orc and screams when he thinks the hobbits have been murdered.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And he breaks his toe. And so that scream is real. He's going, oh, mother... bleep, 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 bleep. And he kind of falls to the floor. And they kept that in because obviously it's so powerful and so real.
Yeah.
I mean, let's not get carried away. Let's not break ourselves to do our craft.
I have done that before.
Yeah,
I had
kicked an orc's head and broke it down.
No. Wait, Jill might actually remember this. Jill and I went to university together before we went to drama school. And I did a show called Look Back in Anger. And I played this kind of slightly femme fatale-esque.
Alison.
Completely against type.
No, you were Helena.
Totally I was Helena. And there's if you've read Look Back in Anger, there's a scene where the guy gets slapped by my character and then they have this passionate kiss. And there was one performance where the guy kissed me and kind of let out this moan and it was really kind of sensual and sexy. I'd actually broken his tooth during the slap,
nice.
And he was bleeding into my mouth. So that moan was actually one of enormous pain.
Yeah.
Beats the milkshake moment.
Blood on milk.
Yeah. Well, I think God probably would have approved.
Yeah. It reminds me of Birdman at the end of Birdman as well. You know, the ultimate piece of performance art. You know, in theatre, you blow your brains out at the end of it.
Yeah.
You can't top that. Really.
Yeah, I like to injure my
performances.
Cool. Well, thank you very much, guys. Really appreciate that.
That was. I was going to say that's the other one. Sorry.
No, it's all right. We need to know what
I've
it is.
As I start to talk, I was like, I've already forgotten what it is. I'm going to try and cover this. But I have remembered Django Unchained. It was you that reminded me of Quentin. Django Unchained, there's a bit where Leo DiCaprio smashes the glass. That blood is real. He cuts his hand in the scene.
He does a lot of improv.
And just keeps going.
Leo
because
actor.
It's
Leo,
like, and I did the same thing when I did my Othello thing. Okay. I stab an apple and I went straight through the apple and into my own hand. And I was bleeding down my arm. I was kind of like, yeah, come on, let's use this. So, yeah.
Yeah, Edward Norton's character in Birdman would approve.
Yeah. Thank you, Edward Norton.
Okay. Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Bye. So, Neil, that was some interesting stuff came out of that. Like I said at the beginning, it didn't really go in the kind of, it went off in sort of different directions, but really fascinating. What did you make of that?
Yeah, I thought it was great. A real interesting insight to how actors kind of respond to those kind of things. Particularly interesting that when they were talking about how they kind of take little bits and pieces from different things and see in a performance an element that they can use, and they can use all those different things to create a new whole, which I think is directly in line with, you know, what we were kind of talking about earlier and what we've discussed about Godard and the French New Wave in terms of bringing together different types of form, different types of approaches to filmmaking to create a new whole out of something that is kind of exists in various places in disparate parts. So that was a nice kind of...
And when one of the guys actually sort of said, you know, there's nothing that's new. You know, everything comes from somewhere else. Which
and he
is,
hadn't
you
even
know,
seen the
and
film.
He hadn't seen the film, yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it's funny, isn't it? Because we discuss this all the time. Is there such a thing as originality? Or is there just a kind of repositioning, a recycling, a redefinition, you know, a development of you know, certain core ideas, whether it be in kind of aesthetics or whether it be in central themes and ideas.
Yeah, and I think that's important because then that takes us back to Godard and say, was Godard doing anything new or was he just bringing a new context? And I think that's always an interesting way of looking at it. So, yeah, I thought that was... I did smile at that because I thought that's kind of what the film is saying.
Absolutely.
In many ways. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, we'll move on now to our discussion part, which came after the screening of Band of Parts. So, let's listen to that. So do you think they filled in their risk assessment for running through the Louvre?
No, I don't think they filled a risk assessment for much.
No.
So
you haven't seen it for a while. What did you make of that?
I was surprised how cruel it was. Like, you know, it's when you I saw it when I was young and impressionable, and it felt very, you know, very cool and very, not inconsequential, but a lot, you know, lighter. But then it just drifts into this really cruel kind of really needy, like, desperation. Those guys are so desperate. And it comes out in their actions, you know.
Yeah.
Everything they do to her is this kind of increasingly desperate, you know, we need that money. And, you know, so that was really surprising, was how... Yeah.
And that coincides, though, with the kind of more absurdist turn it takes towards the end, where it becomes, you know, more theatrical and less about the kind of long takes and the discussions that sort of go on at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, he's almost fulfilling that kind of double prophecy of the philosophy of the star and also this kind of B-movie structure.
Yeah.
So you get that ending where he's just kind of flailing around.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, which is almost kind of surreal and almost slapstick.
I always think there's a kind of trick to watching Godard film. I remember, like, the first time I saw them back, you know, way back when, where you're kind of expecting something to happen. You're expecting the corners to, or the moments to sort of, you know, flow into each other. And it just doesn't happen like that. And you've got to kind of accept that that isn't going to happen. As soon as you do, you let the images wash over you, let what's going on wash over you, rather than waiting for what's coming next, as it were.
But it also still feels really... It feels very fresh. You get the sense that it was made on the spot. You know, there is, it does feel improvised and it does feel made up, but not in a self-indulgent way. It has an urgency to the storytelling. Like, oh, we're gonna digress here, but it's interesting to stop here and digress because visually it's interesting, or the way I'm going to kind of capture it is interesting. And then, well, now let's move on and kind of pick up as we go.
But in terms of, like, for you teaching screenwriting, you couldn't kind of teach that in a way, could you? Because it's kind of like, well, where's the story going? What's going to happen next? You know, where's the structure here? And then there's these sort of moments where it does stop and they go into kind of digressions. But in a sense, it's about that aspect of filmmaking where it is about the moments. I mean, there's the sort of three iconic moments in this film, I think, where they run through the Louvre, there's the dance sequence, and then there's that point where it stops, the sound stops, let's pause for a minute, and which is really interesting to see what the audience reaction is to that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of teaching it, you know, that's, you know, screenwriting is taught as you write the script and then you make the movie.
Sure.
And that whole era feels like you're writing the script as you make the movie. You start from a premise and you go out. There's a rigorousness to making sure that everything works and everything's kind of good and that you shoot enough stuff, but... It's a completely different way of making films.
Well, the dialogues are all written ad hoc, aren't they? You know, day by day. So there's no time. Godard said there's no time for the actors to prepare. So therefore, they have to give themselves more to, you know, the role, but also the sense of what is going on in kind of tone, I think.
Yeah, but very cleverly, because they all knew cinema. They all knew to tie it into existing genres. Yeah. So if you've got a B-movie kind of crime genre, you know that at certain points, if you need to rein it in, you can hit certain points. You know, 400 Blows is a coming-of-age story. You know you can hit certain points. So it gives you that freedom to go off and explore.
Sure.
And then come back knowing, oh, well, we have the old Raymond Chandler, you know, have someone just find a gun.
Yeah.
That'll move the story on for us. You know, it's very smart, I think.
So would anybody like to say anything?
It felt very playful, his style of filmmaking. And the use of sound, was that to involve the audience? So as it felt like it was really noisy the whole way through, and was that to make the audience pay attention when there wasn't any sound at all?
What do you think? I mean, how does it feel to you to watch it? Like, you know, what does that sound, you know, how does that impact your viewing of it?
Well, that's sort of what I felt, that it was quite it makes you realise that you're watching a film, so it involves you as an audience member in that way. But it's also I found it quite difficult to get used to the amount of sound and all the different noises that are going on, and quite distracting.
It's that word, self-reflexive. It's reflecting on itself as a cinematic, you know, object, as it were. I mean, there's that amazing moment right at the beginning where the sound comes in and she wheels the bike, and it cuts exactly when she puts the bike up against the wall. I mean, that's obviously, you know, anti-realist. It doesn't work in that way. But it's calling attention to a use of sound to emphasise a particular moment that doesn't have anything to do with the flow of continuity in terms of form that we would be used to.
Yeah, and there is no continuity in terms of how he's using sound. He's using sound very differently throughout. So there's a scene in the cafe where they're talking, and it's just a cacophony. You know, there's no mixing. It's just, it's pure, this is what's captured. So at different times he's just using so many different techniques.
And then there's the counterpoise of the silent moment. I mean, how do people feel uncomfortable about that? Is that the kind of effect that people were waiting? And then when they break the silence, it's kind of, thank God for that, you know, waiting for something to happen. Anybody else want to make a comment or a question?
Yeah, it's interesting what he does with the sound, because... I don't quite know how he did the sound in the dance scene. I've never been able to work out what happened, whether it was recorded, it was filmed silently, and they knew the dance because of the steps, and it was all worked out with the percussive nature of the steps, or whether there was music on there and the music was captured as they did the dance to the music, and then that moment where it just becomes the steps, they cut the music out afterwards and then dubbed in the footsteps. Whatever way that he did it, I think what that highlights is the brilliant potential to experiment with sound, which I don't think we do as filmmakers. I don't think necessarily it's the first thing we do. We kind of encourage to experiment if we are going to experiment with the form visually, but in terms of the audio, we don't do it as much. And the potential for creativity is much greater because it's much, at a very base level, it's much cheaper to experiment with audio than it is visually. And what I'd like about it, it kind of harks back to the time where you shot silently and you added everything back in. What that allows you to do is add everything back in and then gradually remove things to direct the viewer around the screen using audio. And obviously Bresson was the kind of master of this, and the famous example is within Pickpocket, where it sounds like it's all natural sound and all the sound elements there, and he gradually removes the sound elements till you're focusing on one element of the screen. So I think Rachel's right, that kind of playfulness is fantastic. He kind of works within the form, and he goes to one end of the form and he goes, oh, look what I can do over here, and then he goes to another extreme and goes, oh, I can do this over here. And I think we don't really have that anymore. And if people do something like that, you go, oh, that's experimental, and you put it in a pigeonhole and consider it as something that's separate to, you know, to the potential of this form, which is so under realized at the moment.
Or it's just a kind of a use of surround sound in terms of, here is something on the screen, go from there to there. So we'll use surround sound to go from there to there. Oh, that's cool. But it's really unsophisticated, that, in comparison to what we're seeing here.
Exactly, because, yeah. I mean, you know, we had the Oscars last night, and I don't know, I couldn't care less.
Really,
it's a polite way of saying it. But I imagine the technical Oscar that was given for sound design is, you know, hugely deserved. But I don't necessarily, but I think it's there to kind of trick us and to make us feel, you know, emotionally connect, but not necessarily to intellectually connect, which I think is what Godard does with sound.
Luca, did you want to add?
Talking about the whole playfulness of the whole film is basically during that scene, I spent my whole time just watching the actors because I could tell that they were enjoying themselves. They were trying to contain themselves. They were kind of smiling. They were just like, being playful in the sense that they were letting the audience watch them and not really care what they had to do. They were just there, kind of like twiddling their thumbs, having that moment of peace.
Yeah, I think there's a sense of, I don't know how much this was directed, but there's definitely a sense of the actors knew that they are performing a character, and the characters are performing their characters. Do you see what I mean? It's not like, you know, you get these moments where they're pretending to shoot each other and all of this kind of stuff. And like in the school at the beginning, where they're playing that game of passing, you know, passing the notes and all that, that they're, the characters themselves are performing real people, but they're not really real people at all. Everything about it is a construction, I think. I think the performances are just part of that.
Yeah, they're wonderful. And it's such a free moment before the film becomes very, very different. And even when they're running around the Louvre, there's a sense of tension, because we've seen Arthur and the kind of the situation at home with his uncle and stuff. So we know everything is kind of shifted. So there is, you know, it's not as free and as, it's so innocent, that scene, because they're just kind of, and it's, what I love about it as well, you know, sort of go back to what Mark was saying, is it's one shot.
Mm.
The camera doesn't move. Everything is in the sound, and there's like 10 different techniques, and it's just, but it feels so cinematic, even though the camera's doing so little because of the attention. It's, yeah, it's such a wonderful, wonderful scene.
Is anyone brave enough to make a criticism and say that they didn't like it for whatever reason? Or they have something to say that is critical? No, nobody's brave enough to
Maybe
to
we'll
say,
get there.
Maybe we'll get there. Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is supposed to be the most accessible of his films. And, you know, there's still a sense in which you could kind of say, well, you know, what is going on at certain points? It kind of makes no sense. It meanders around. If you're looking for an explanation of story, of narrative, of even of theme, it's very difficult to kind of say with certainty what anything means in a way.
Yeah, and it's, if you're, you know, raised on a diet of the last 20 years of cinema, there's very little in that that feels, you know, relatable in terms of how films are made or how we kind of watch films. And it's still critical. It's still at that period where he's in love with cinema, but he's also being a critic, and he's also being critical of the form throughout. So you get that very critical voice as well as this authorial voice, which is, it's just so unusual. So, sure. You know, even like we were talking about Alex Cox last week, he is a critic, he is a theorist, he is someone who's a teacher of cinema, but he rarely brings that in, you know, whereas this is all in there. What was interesting as well, you know, it's he throws so much at the wall, you know, and he always has done in terms of his politics and everything. But there's that line in there about England's dead and China will win. And I just sort of turned to you, I was like, you know, 50 years later, whatever it is, 60, yeah, and it's yeah, just, that's right. It. That's, you know, it's funny how, you know, how bang on cinematically and in some of the politics of that era, it's just,
for sure.
You know, his intelligence, it might be pretentious to put it up there, but, you know, he is a very smart man.
Should we give away a book?
We're going to give away a book.
Okay.
Yeah, we've got a competition already, two episodes in.
Oh, do you want to grab it? It's over there. Okay, so we were trying to think of a question or a quote, and I've got a couple of copies of this, so I thought I'd give one away.
It's it's Richard Rood, Richard Roud's book, Book on Goddard.
Okay, so we're going to give you a quote, and the first person to come up with the answer as to the filmmaker who said this about Goddard. And it's rather disparaging, okay? So who said this? And I'll give you some clues in case you don't know. Who said this about Goddard? He is for intellectual counterfeit money when compared to a good kung fu film. Any guesses? No, do we need a clue? Okay, here's a clue. Penguins of Madagascar. Film students here are letting us down.
Yeah.
Well done.
Well done, Luca, well done.
Well done.
Luca wins the book.
Congratulations. So we are. We'll end it there. I think we're going to go for a drink at the bar if anybody wants to join us. Thank you very much for coming to our first two screenings. There won't be one now for a few weeks, but we'll let you know when the next one is and when we've decided what film it's going to be. We're thinking Japanese, but
yeah, we're looking at maybe the talking about the canon and the idea of the canon a bit, and maybe screening a Kurosawa.
Sure.
If there's anything short enough, maybe we should screen in two parts. And sort of hopefully having a guest who will introduce a film by a female filmmaker.
Yeah,
so
indeed.
That's what.
So we're not all guy heavy all the time. But thanks for coming, and hopefully we'll see you next time. So that was the discussion for After Band Apart. So how do you think that went, Neil?
I thought it was great. I thought it was a really good discussion came out of that. And it was nice to see some returning faces from last week and some new faces.
Yeah.
And I think it's a film which definitely provoked more discussion, I think, you know, to do with its form and because of Goddard.
I think we got to a slightly deeper level of kind of discussion around the film, which perhaps the film lent itself to that anyway, I think.
Yeah, no, but it was good. It was encouraging that, you know, the first couple of weeks have kind of been so positive in terms of, you know, sort of engaged audiences willing to come out and support it, which is great, and we appreciate that. And also, to kind of, you know, to take the film on board and think about it and talk about it, which is obviously what the aim of the whole thing was.
So that, our next screening is going to be in 3 weeks or so. So we've had a few discussions, haven't we, about what's coming up. So we're thinking a film that is that leads us into a discussion about canons and why are great films considered great films and what gets left out and what gets put in.
Yeah, I think that would be so maybe something that's from a filmmaker who's regarded as canonical. Those films are always really long, so we're trying to find
a shortish one,
which is short enough. But then leading, because, you know, we've sort of talked about how can we kind of engage with that, but we thought it'd be interesting to talk about maybe the gaps, maybe you know, those guilts, you know, the guilt that kind of rides along with kind of being an academic in film and you haven't seen. So that's something we're looking at, and then we're hoping to screen a film by a female filmmaker and talk about that's where we might kind of merge with kind of contemporary debates, you know,
absolutely,
in a very important way. So and we've got a colleague who's interested in screening a film, so we might sort of work with her on that and
try to get away from being completely guy heavy with our
discussion.
Yeah,
well, that's the thing. You know, we are conscious of it, and it's something that we want to
absolutely.
But also, I think, you know, further on in the future, we've talked about kind of, you know, the people that we work with on the podcast, kind of programming stuff, so that we can look at stuff outside of our own, you know, sort of direct you know, our direct circumstances, which is definitely what we want this podcast to do.
Okay, fantastic. So that has been the podcast for this week. The show has been produced by James Chatwin, Michael Tibbins, and Marcus Thorne.
Thank you there.
Thank
for
you
their
for
work.
Those guys. Yeah. you can download the podcast at our website, which is www.cinematologist.com. We'd love to hear your comments as well. Hopefully, we'll get some discourse between people online. So you can find us on Facebook, and we are also on Twitter at cinematologist. So this has been the Cinematologists Podcast.